With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem-solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
It is the Weekender. I'm Neil Atkinson. And with me, I've got Adam Smith, Kathy Long, Chloe Bloxham, and Dan Morgan. What are we going to talk about? Well, we're going to start off being a bit Junior Wijnaldum-ish. Let's be honest about that. We know how that's likely to work, and with one eye on Thiago as well. We'll then move ourselves along, and we're going to be chatting to Amelie Threstrup from Liverpool Women. They've got a massive game coming up on Sunday, and we'll be talking about that as well in towards the end of the show. And Josh Sexton spoke to Noel Clark. That is to come too. All the big hits for this one, for this Weekender this week. So we'll get on to the issue stuff later on, but we will start with Jeannie Wijnaldum. And Kathy, I'll start with you. The first thing to say is it was a bit sad when Adam Lallana went, and everyone's got a different view on Dejan Lovren, and it's a bit sad when he went. But the American sports writer Michael McCambridge said to me after the Chelsea game that it'll be the last time, possibly in their lives, that these men are all in the same room. And that's something that's a really strange thing to think about. These men who've won a Champions League and a league for Liverpool, it could be the last time they'll all be in the same room. And while in some level we miss Adam Lallana and some of us will miss Dejan Lovren, I think most of us, if our hearts are where our hearts should be, would deeply and profoundly miss Gini Wijnaldum if he was the first of these lads who've delivered the first league title in 30 years to go.
Feels to me like this is the first time with this team that we're looking at someone leaving in which it would be a real, it feels like a real kick in the guts, because he's such an integral part of the team, not just of the squad. You know, he's one of those players who makes it all tick and doesn't always, I think, get the praise that he deserves, because he's sort of silently just moving around the pitch, making it all work. And I just think, as you say, it's like he's become such an integral part of the way that we play. And that, and one of those players that just gets on with the job and makes such a significant difference that, yeah, it's the first time when I think I've really felt like this is a massive, feels like a massive change for us. But I also have confidence, I think, in the way that we've been managing this team and managing players coming in and out, that the transition should be seamless to whoever else we bring in. And that's the important thing for me, you know. I mean, I'm gutted if Ginny goes. But it's about seamless transition for me.
It will be about seamless transitions, and it will be about feeling like the side moves on in a way that is that is positive. But if he does leave, if this is the end of Gini Wijnaldum's time at Liverpool, as Kathy says, it is the first one, arguably since Coutinho. But in essence, this project changes when Coutinho leaves. He's the catalyst to something. It'll be the first time that you feel as though someone who, in a way that we get to see on the pitch, someone who is at the centre of so much of this. He plays our fifth highest total of Premier League minutes, 18-19, our sixth highest, 19-20, across every single position. That includes goalkeeper, you know. That's pretty significant that, you know, that's the player, that's the first one who looks increasingly like he may well move on in the next 3, 4, 5 days.
Yeah, he's still a first name on the team sheet for me. And I think you can have arguments around sort of playing him away from home. I know we sort of scoffed at that after a couple of months of having him after he signed from Newcastle, but I think there is a thing there with his influence away. I don't think it's as big as it is at Anfield, and you know, you can have those sort of arguments as to whether he is in anyone's ideal midfield three. But if he stays next season, then I'd expect him to play sort of 50 plus games easy from the start, and that for me is sort of where the decision should be, really, in terms of keeping hold of him. But we all know it's not as simple as that. I just wonder whether there's a couple of things here. It does very much feel like the beginning of the end in many ways of sort of the transition of this team. And I wonder whether there's something Milner related within this, in that they've sort of decided to keep Milner for 2 years at least. I think they might think he's got another year in him beyond that. And I wonder whether there's just a couple of scenarios pitted around this squad where, and I put the front three in this as well, where they're saying, yeah, okay, they get old on our clock, but we can't have sort of two or three of them getting old together. We have to sort of make decisions. Yeah, we have to sort of cut this in half a little bit. I think there's obvious outliers like Van Dijk with that, but I wonder whether Wijnaldum has just fallen into that camp. And the other thing I think as well, Neil, is kind of, I wonder whether this is the first time that it's sort of the data and the analysis that they use working in a different way. And I wouldn't be surprised if sort of they've used those metrics and decided that in 2 years' time he's not going to be able to give the output that they need. And if they give him what he wants for 4 years now, then basically it's not going to add up economically and financially. And I wonder whether that's what we're seeing. You know, we often use data and analysis as sort of a positive all the time in a way in which it influences positive results. I wonder if this is the first time they're using it saying, well, hang on a minute, you know, the monetary value here doesn't really work.
Could well be the case, Chloe, with them. It's also though worth pointing out, Liverpool have lost Lallana, who's an important player within the squad, off the pitch. When they did the vice-captain vote, Wijnaldum comes fourth behind Van Dijk, the idea that, you know, Henderson would remain captain, Milner second, but they voted on who they wanted. And it's interesting to me, Wijnaldum comes in there in fourth place. He always seems very, very switched on, like a lot of these Liverpool players do, seems very, very engaged with the wider world and with his squad. And the point is here, with Lallana going as well, you know, it's legitimate to have concerns. Liverpool are left with a little bit of a hole in terms of the leadership that has been at the club.
Yeah, and I think, you know, you look at Gini Wijnaldum, and whether you realise it or not, every single player on that pitch has a bond with him, every single player, especially Joe Gomez, who's centre-half and, you know, he's best mates with Gini Wijnaldum and Virgil van Dijk. You know, this team have bonded together. They've been the rebuild of Liverpool Football Club. They've achieved the greatest things that Liverpool Football Club have done together. So, you know, naturally when you lose that person, that leader, that voice in the dressing room, you know, you're going to feel maybe a bit deflated. But as you know, I fully trust in Liverpool, their philosophy, everything that Liverpool do. And I think and I hope that they have a backup plan for if he does go. I'd be really upset to see him go, especially this year. I can understand, you know, him going next year because we won't offer him a 4-year contract, and the fact that, you know, how many years does he have left in him, that's good. And then are you paying him excess amount of money for him maybe not starting those games because he doesn't have it in him anymore? But if he does go out, I'll be extremely sad just because of what he's gave to this club. He came from Newcastle and maybe people thought, you know, he probably won't be as good as he first looked, or, you know, he's came from a lower team. A bit like Andy Robbo, you know, he came from Hull who got relegated. And when you look at those players, you bring in players from those teams, you wonder if they can do it consistently at a higher level to reach the likes of the title. And he's came in and took it by storm, and he's a very, very important part of the puzzle. You know, when I look at that midfield three, and people talk about Thiago, if we had that midfield three, for me, I couldn't drop my captain, I couldn't drop Henderson, I couldn't drop Fabinho, because Fabinho has a role which I think only him can boss to the full extent. I think he can do everything from that position. And then there's Gini Wijnaldum, who pretty much similar to Jordan Henderson, he's a kind of a box-to-box midfielder, he'll track everything, he runs down. And I think if you brought Thiago in and kept Gini Wijnaldum, I think Thiago would start on the bench for me at this moment in time. I think, you know, that's why I'd rather see Thiago be brought in now and Gini Wijnaldum stay for an extra year, so you can get him that game time over the period of the full, you know, year, the full season. So he's not just going straight into that lineup and you're saying, do us a job for us. You know, at first you're going to let him understand what you want from him, the role of what you want from him, and then try and put it in the games. But, you know, and then you've also got Gini Wijnaldum, who potentially knows that he's then going to go next season and then can help Thiago out off outside of the football, saying, well, this is how we press, this is when you should press. I just think, you know, Gini Wijnaldum, if any player leaves, you know, even Dejan Lovren, I was upset for Adam Lallana, who didn't play that many games, was injured more times than I can remember. I was so sad to see him go. So I'd be extremely sad to see Gini Wijnaldum go, who's brought me arguably one of the best nights in my life when it comes to Barcelona. You know, and he's got passion for the football club, and even though I don't want him to go, if he truly wants to go and if he truly thinks it's best right now for him and he'd like to go to Barcelona, then we're not going to stop him. I just hope we then have, you know, a reinforced plan.
There's the reinforced plan, as Chloe's just mentioned there, you know, one of the best nights of her life, the game against Barcelona. And I think that these players will be moving on. They are going to move from the category of current Liverpool players to Liverpool legends at some sort of stage. And that's one of the reasons why, to me, this is just a little bit sad if it does transpire, as is currently being reported, that he may well go to Barcelona. Not because he's finished. I don't think that for a second. I'm sure he'll do well at Barcelona. But it is like the beginning of the end of a phase. And that's not to say Liverpool can't still be winning major honours in 10 years' time off the basis of all of this. But instead, it just signals, you know, you can possibly, because of when he was signed into the summer of 2016, the goal he gets at the end of the 16-17 season to return Champions League football, the fact that he scores in the semi-final against Roma, the semi-final two against Barcelona, big goals against Cardiff thrown in there as well, that all get all too easily forgotten. But it just almost feels as though this era will, if he goes now, my mild concern is that we'll talk about the Gini Wijnaldum in 5 years. It'll actually belong oddly to him.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. And I think there's loads of realities, aren't there, all around it all, that as football fans it's difficult to face. And the reality is that in 2-3 years, probably most, if not all, of the front three will have gone. Jordan Henderson will have left, if not retired. You know, all those kind of things that we're kind of... It's a little bit like... this is the most nonsense thing I've ever come up with, but it's a little bit like when you've got a pet and you know the pet's getting older, but you're like, no, he's fine. What do you mean? He's 15. That's no problem. He's going to live forever. And you sort of ignore the reality that actually it's, you know, it's getting older and life moves on and you need to disband it. And Ian Rush doesn't play for us anymore. And Kenny Dalglish isn't the manager. And there's like a sort of these things need to move on. And Wijnaldum in that kind of sense is he's the start, perhaps, of us starting to say goodbye to an era that we really don't want to say goodbye to because of how much joy we've had. And it's about more than just the success on the pitch. It's about, we weren't winning anything under Klopp, but everyone was having a bloody brilliant time. And that kind of holding on to that, wow, I do not want these players to leave. I do not want to say goodbye to these lads who've done so well for us. It's a difficult thing to kind of get to, I guess. But the flip side of it is that these things are so complicated, that there's so many moving parts at a football club and involved in a transfer and all that sort of stuff, because Gini Wijnaldum might well be looking at it and going, do you know what, I've won the Premier League and I've won the Champions League, there's nothing left for me to win here, because who cares about the domestic trophies? So I want to go and do, I've not got that many years left, I want to go and win something somewhere else. And Liverpool might be looking at it, as Dan said before, and looking at the underlying metrics and going, well, he's probably only got another year or two left of that output, so if we're going to sell him, now is probably the peak moment to sell him, and maybe thinking now's the time to do it. And I wonder, just for example, I wonder whether they maybe look at Divock Origi at the end of last season after the Champions League and think, maybe we missed the chance to sell him when we could have got a huge amount of money for him, and now we're not going to get that money that we maybe could have got back then for him, and we don't want to be in the same position with Wijnaldum. And yeah, we could let his contract run out, but we also live in a reality right now where we haven't got huge amounts of money. So if we do want to bring Thiago in, which the manager seems like he wants to, then we're going to have to get that money from someone. There's all these cogs moving around that, as supporters, I think you just go, no, I don't. No, that's none of my. Just buy everyone. That's fine. Keep Wijnaldum. Buy Thiago. Do everything. That's what I want to do. And the football club can't think like that. And I don't believe that Michael Edwards and the crew that with the in the air conditioned office, I don't think they've lost their ability to know what's right and what's wrong in terms of transfers. So I think they're looking at it and going, now's the time to pull the trigger. As sad as that is, and it's maybe the end of an era, but it could be the start of another one. And that's maybe, if he goes, how we're going to end up looking at it.
There are three different ways, Cathy, and let's really, you know, start discussing our mortality here, and let's get genuinely metaphysical. There are three different ways that you can support a football club, and one is by living in the past, and one is by living in the present, and one is by living in the future. And there is a living in the future argument, where you have the argument with Gini Wijnaldum, he's a highly paid professional, and we just don't look back and we keep thinking about, well, what's the next thing? I think that living in the past is ultimately a negative. Things move on and you can't get trapped in that. But there is a vague sort of moment here where I do feel in a really weird way for all the ways people are trying to, because we have to do currently, given the nature of the world, a lot of communication online. It's fair to discuss online communication where you can split Liverpool supporters, and there's a desire to split them in a number of different ways. But I actually think there's a number of people who are genuinely eager just to live in the present. And there's a number of people who are constantly just looking to live in the future. And those two things are rubbing up against one another. So right now there is a real desire for, from some to say Thiago was an upgrade on Wijnaldum, whereas there's others who want to be able to say, well, hang on, there's what this player offered us, what he gave us, and what he has given us in the present tense. To discuss something 2 years ago in the terms of this football project is a present tense conversation, not a past tense one. And I think that this is a really interesting little schism, a really interesting little split. And it's almost as much about how people's brains work as it is anything else.
I think so. Yeah, I think it's spot on. And I think it's about, it's not about anxiety that we feel when there's change, that is inevitable, that, you know, when we're not happy with the way things are going. And as a fan, when you're anxious about the team, it's like people want constant change, want people to be brought in, you know, you're constantly desiring for things to be different. And of course you get to the point we're in now where we love this team. We love the way that they play. We love the relationships they have with each other. We love the strength. We love the fact that we've got so many leaders in the team. But it's one thing I used to complain about not so long ago when it felt like we had no leaders. Now we've got a team full of leaders. You know, Gini is often talked about as someone who would be a captain. You know, the players have said that in the past, that if it wasn't Hendo, you know, Gini would be their choice. But I think also you can learn from the past. You know, I remember when I was obviously very, very small, being absolutely gutted that our star player was leaving, because I just thought this was the end of everything, because all I'd known at my very, very tiny age was that Kevin Keegan was everything, and that without him, we would not be Liverpool Football Club anymore. And we were signing some fella from Scotland. It was like, who is this Kenny? What's his name again? You know, Kenny Dalglish. So I think I learned very early on to understand about those transitions. So, and I think I'm more relaxed about it. I do feel, you know, yes, Ginny is incredibly important in what he's given to the team and in the way that we play. And I'm already exhausted with people talking about Thiago. So I think where I try to be is living in the present, but trusting in the future, if that makes sense. I can't get too upset about transfers and who's going to sign and who's not going to sign. I'm already tired of hearing about Thiago. I've loved it when we've just signed players and it's been a surprise, you know.
Excellent.
You get too anxious about it, you know, and that anxiety isn't healthy at all.
Anxiety is most definitely not healthy. This is supporting a football team. It is, after all, a leisure activity. Thank you very much to the four. We'll be back with them in a few minutes. Before then, we've got Amelie Threstrup and we've got Noel Clark. And it is the Anfield Wrap. It is the weekend. I'm back in a sec.
It's Andy Heaton for the weekend, and I'm delighted to be joined via Zoom chat by Liverpool Women's FC new striker, Amelie Threstrup. Amelie, thanks for joining us on the show.
Thanks for having me on.
Obviously, you're on the line. The women's season is about to kick off. Everything's going forward, and Liverpool kick off the season against Sunday. And you know, it seems to be, obviously, with everything going on in the world, it must be just really exciting to get back on the pitch and playing again.
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, I don't think you know, anyone on the team really has been playing a competitive match since, you know, February, March. So we're just, you know, buzzing to get back, and it almost feels like Christmas came early this year. It's so exciting, and we can't wait.
Brilliant. How's pre-season gone for you girls? I mean, we were privileged to come down a couple of times and watch you guys train down at the Solar campus. You know, everyone's re-energized for the season. Vicky's been really positive in the comments I've read from her. You really, you know, is it real motivation to get going and really hit the season hard?
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, I think that, you know, the motivation and just the whole atmosphere in the group has been great from day one. I think everyone is, you know, really excited to be back and get going, and, you know, excited for the season. I think it'll be, you know, a good season. We have a strong side all around the pitch. So we're really excited, and preseason has been really great. You know, we've gotten to play a lot of friendlies and against, you know, a lot of good teams as well. So I think that we've been tested, and that's been really great for the team.
And there's been a lot of change over the close season. Obviously, you know, last season didn't go as well as everyone would have hoped, and, you know, Liverpool will feel they deserve to be in the women's Premier Division. And obviously, there's been a couple of changes. Susan Black's come in now as well. you know, and without getting too far ahead of ourselves, and know we obviously take it one game at a time, that must be like the key aim, for the focus to just get back where this club belongs.
Yeah, I mean, for us right now, I think our main focus is on the game against Durham on Sunday. You know, we want to get off to a good start and get those 3 points. So our main focus is on that game, and that's, you know, what we're talking about and what we're looking forward to in training right now.
So you talk about the game specifically against Durham. So it's Sunday, 2 o'clock, is that right? And it's still at Prenton Park. But we have to remind you can watch it live on the FA Play. Now, obviously, we're still behind closed doors, which must be frustrating for you as it is for us. But, yeah, I mean, obviously we hope to kickstart, to get a good start and get those 3 points on the board.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we're sad that, you know, we can't have fans at the stadium. Look, we were, and I was personally as well, looking really forward to play in front of them. But, you know, it's important to stay safe, and we hope that, you know, the fans will be following from home from the FA Player, and we'll do our best to, you know, make them proud and get the win, and then hopefully they'll be back in the stadium as soon as possible.
So, Emily, I've just been having a quick look at your history. For those that might not know, obviously we know you're a forward. So, how would you describe your game to someone who might not have seen you play before? What can we expect from yourself?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that I'm an aggressive forward. You know, I like to get, you know, both in behind, but also kind of link up with my teammates. And, you know, I like to think that I'm good at, you know, creating chances and scoring goals. So I think that's the expectations I set for myself, and that's what people can expect from me. So I'm excited.
And obviously you share history with a couple of the men's team. You've come over from Roma, and obviously I was just looking, if this move goes as well as the last two from Roma, Alisson and Mo, then, you know, it's going to be absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, big shoes to fill, but obviously I'll do my best to do so. And, you know, it's a great history between Roma and Liverpool. And the aim is obviously to try to fill those shoes, because obviously that went, you know, amazing. And I can only dream of, you know, making such an impact that the Roma players coming to Liverpool have.
But did you have a great experience? What was Roma like? Was it a good experience for you? I mean, it sounds like, I love Italy anyway, and I love Roma. I mean, was it like being out there and playing football in Italy?
Yeah, no, it was a great experience. You know, Roma is obviously a historic club in Italy and in Europe as well. So to getting to represent such a big club was amazing. And, you know, the Italian league is also really moving forward. So it was extremely exciting to be a part of that league and compete. And yeah, I mean, I look back at it as a really, really good season.
Have you just going back to Liverpool a bit? How have you settled in with the women? You're getting on with them great. It's a good group to be along. There's loads of energy at the minute. I mean, I remember, we've interviewed Rizzola before, and she's always just there, effusive, and she's really talented player. You're looking forward to linking up with her specifically.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's a great group of girls. They've been so welcoming since day one. And I feel like it was such an easy transition into the group. And like you said, you know, there's a lot of talent on the team, everywhere on the pitch. And Rins is obviously, you know, her speed is the fastest out there, pretty much. So I'm really looking forward to link up with her. I think that we complement each other really well. And I think that, you know, hopefully we'll do good things together, her and I, and as a team throughout the season.
Fantastic. And obviously, just going through, I know I mentioned it before, pre-season with Vicky, what's training been like? Are they working you hard? Because there's always a lot of folks on the men's game. We don't really talk about the women's game enough. And, you know, you listen to the men's interviews with Milner, and he talks about the lactate tests and grinding and running and, you know, almost flogging you to death to a point. Has it been tough?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, preseason is the time to get us in the best shape as possible. Obviously, both the physical part and the tactical and the technical as well. So, you know, we've been working hard on all three aspects, and I think that, you know, we're in great shape. We've had our tests, and compared to the one we did right when we came in, everyone has improved, and, you know, we're really fit and ready. So it's been. I mean, tough, but preseason has to be tough in order to be ready for the season to start. So I think that, you know, we're really in great shape and ready to get rolling.
Just away from Liverpool again for a second, it's a really exciting time for women's football in general. You've got the Women's Champions League final coming up, which seems to be getting a lot of focus. I mean, that must be pleasing for yourself as well as, you know, the people at the club, and something to aim for in the medium to long-term future.
Oh, definitely. I think that, you know, the final was a great showcasing of women's football. I think that, you know, you see great teams going through the Champions League every year, and there's more and more focus, which is obviously, you know, amazing to witness and to be a part of that development. Of course, you know, Wolfsburg had Danish, my Danish fellow Dane, Pernille Harder, on the team. So I was hoping that, you know, she could bring the trophy back. But Lyon is a great side. We've seen it 5 years straight. Unbelievable. So I think that, you know, every year we really see women's football moving forward. And that's really great to, you know, witness and be a part of.
Well, I personally can't wait to come and see you guys. I've been over a couple of times with my daughter last season to Prenton Park watches, and she's really inspired by, you know, watching you guys and doing what you do. And hopefully, you know, this season we're going to have a little bit more to cheer about. But Emily, thanks so much for your time. We really appreciate you for joining us on the Anfield Rep on this weekend, the show, and good luck for Sunday.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me on. It was a pleasure. Brilliant.
It's John Gibbons and Neil Atkinson here to talk about Beer 52. And Beer 52 have partnered with us for a while now, and we're very grateful to them. And they've been good partners. But, you know, we've been good partners to them, Neil, or good subscribers. Do you think they sit around and go, Neil Atkinson, he's one of our best?
I hope 3 or 4 of them subscribe to the Anfield Rap, to be honest with you, John. It works both ways.
passing imaginary money around to each other.
Yeah, we're just sort of, it's literally how the economy works, this. You know, that's what it's all about. You know, they're sitting in theirs, sort of thinking, I can't wait for the further delivery to my door, or should I say my phone, of quality podcasts from all around the globe. They're saying to themselves, that's the way in which it works. Yes, different themes right the way through from them. It'd be New Zealand, South Africa, Korea, all over the USA and Europe. And no, I'm waiting for my next delivery. Should have been today, so the fella might now come tomorrow, because I had to nip out this afternoon. So hopefully that'll be getting delivered tomorrow, and then I can crack back on and start enjoying the Beer 52.
We've started doing social gatherings a bit. I mean, not just me and you, the whole world, you know, started having people around. And I think it's become quite a good thing to impress people with, I think, when the Beer 52 is in. You're like, do you want a beer? And they're like, what have you got? And I'm like, well, let me show you.
There's two ways of looking at it. It's either a good thing to impress them with, or to offload the 8% gear. And it's, and not say anything, you know, open it, hand it to them, let them discover what they're into in their own time. This is nice, isn't it? It is, yeah. Tastes a bit lively. Couldn't answer to that. Oh, it's 8.1%. Oh, well, you know, you just have a glass of water next. Yeah, it's that's my having people around Beer 52 formula. Is, yeah, I'll shift on the ones that just look a little bit too rich for my blood, but it's really good. It's all delicious, to be frank, and we, you know, and it's the wide variety that I like, and I also just like the fact that it's dead low maintenance. And I also, in the same way that we've had this chat in the past about, like, when you see Dev and chatting about the wine, like, one of the things I like is I never feel like I'm having a craft beer conversation about Beer 52. I'm just having a sound one. And yeah, Everyone's saying, this is nice. Yes, it is. And then you go from there, because it is basically for everyone.
Yeah, so if you want to join, if you go to beer52.com/wrap, that's beer52.com/wrap, sorry, it's 52 as in the number, and wrap obviously with a W, you will get your first case of 8 beers for just $5.95. So that's a cost of the postage to you, and you'll get 8 beers, and you'll get involved. And if you enjoy it, obviously you can stay subscribed and get every month like Neil does. If it's not for you, you can cancel, and everyone will be happy enough with that. But there's 150,000 people now who are involved, wow, and they do enjoy it. So there you are. They must be doing something right. So that link again is beer52.com/wrap. Get your first case of 8 beers for just $5.95.
Hiya, it's another cup of tea show. It's maybe going out as part of our weekender as well, but I'm sure you'll know that by this point of listening to it. I'm delighted to say that we're joined by actor, writer, producer, Noel Clark. Noel, thanks very much for joining us, first and foremost.
Thanks for having me, man. I appreciate it.
No, it's all good. Yeah, doing research for this interview, I obviously started where all good interviewers do, by typing your name into Google, and what it said on there about you, it said you became known for your role in Doctor Who. To be honest, I actually became familiar with you through your role as Sam Peel in Kid Uphood, But speaking to some of the old lads that they first set out, feed the same pet, which when you're sort of like walking the streets and somebody notices you, what's the role they most associate you with, do you think?
Probably it would have been any of the three you mentioned just then until recently with Bulletproof, but which I think has got a lot more younger people going, oh mate, you're from Bulletproof. But it's kind of equal between our Vida Same Pet with people that are sort of 40 and over, you know, Doctor Who with families, whenever you see families, and then Kidulthood with people from like 16 to 30 who were kind of maybe 15 when it came out, 10 to 15 when it came out, and are now 25, 30 or, you know, around that. So it's kind of equal with those three.
And I think we should start back by jumping sort of back to before your acting days. I know some people just sort of stumble across a career in acting and sort of realise they've got that talent for it. But for others, it's, you know, the heart set on it from a sort of young age. Which one of those would you say you sort of were?
My heart was set on it from a young age. Before I really even knew what it was, I just knew that I wanted to be one of the people on the movie screen or the TV screen. I think, you know, growing up with my mum, you know, sometimes she would have to, you know, not sometimes, I mean, she would have to go to work. She was a nurse. And so sometimes she worked a Saturday, Sunday shift. So she'd be like, right, don't open the door for strangers, da, 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 you know, and she'd go to work, leave my snacks on the side. This is your snacks. This is your lunch. This is this, whatever. And I just put the TV on and just watch TV and watch films. So that kind of just got me like, wow, I'd love to do that, you know?
And so how did you sort of start to get into that career then? What were the first sort of steps that you took to on your road to becoming an actor?
Well, I always tried. I always tried to find little drama things in my area. But back when I was growing up, there wasn't a lot of that stuff. And then I couldn't afford any sort of drama class or drama school. So I just did what I could in school. So I did like GCSE drama and A-level theatre studies. And then I tried to go to uni to do media and film, but kind of it wasn't for me. I wasn't academic to that level at that age, and so I kind of dropped out of uni. But I just kept trying to find little classes and trying to do things. And then I just met a director when I was a gym instructor as well, a fitness instructor, and I met a director while I was working in the gym, and just basically said like, please let me audition for this thing. I heard you're doing this thing for Channel 4. Please let me audition. He was like, cool, and he let me audition. I got the role. And that was the start of it.
And I mentioned those sort of different roles at the start, which came pretty early in your sort of on-screen career. But how do you prepare for those different roles? Like how does Noel Clarke go into Sam Peel and that kind of thing?
I think you have to find what's in you, right? So, you know, with Mickey from Doctor Who, I find the nerd in me, you know, the sort of easygoing, affable part of me that I know I can walk into any room and get on with anyone, anywhere. And you use that kind of part of you because Mickey's that sort of character. And then, you know, for Sam, you just find the part of you growing up in the area I grew up in, that part of you that had to always be on guard and have to always be, you know, defensive and ready. And you find that part of you and you use that. So I wouldn't say for me it's any training that I had in drama school. It's pulling up the raw stuff that I can find, or the things that I can use and try and put them into the characters.
And you mentioned the area you grew up in, that's Ladbroke Grove in West London, if I'm not mistaken. And Kidulthood is sort of the depiction of lives of teenage from that area, isn't it? And people might watch that and think like, wow, that looks like quite an intense upbringing. But what was that upbringing like for you, like growing up in Ladbroke Grove?
It was like that, because that's where Kidulthood set. The Ladbroke Grove area is the same area now. It's the same area, that Latimer Ladbroke Grove area where I grew up, is the same area where the Grenfell Tower had the fire. You know, that unfortunate area, place, right? So that area is one of the most underfunded areas in the country, is what I heard. And definitely was when I was young anyway. But if you know about that area, it sits in the borough of Kensington and Chelsea, which is one of the richest boroughs of Europe. And two roads away, or basically the same area, is Notting Hill as well. And if people, you tell people you live in Notting Hill, they go, oh, la-di-da, da-da-da-da-da. But it's the same area.
Yeah.
That part's just in the north of it. And then, you know, Notting Hill is a bit further south, but I mean, it's a 5-minute walk. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So obviously, Kiddohood was just kind of, that was kind of what it was like. There's some exaggerations, like the uncle drilling the gun, you know, but it comes from things I knew, people I knew and stuff that, you know, I knew people were involved with.
And obviously when you see the sort of the success that Kiddohood had, Adulthood had, even Brotherhood that you brought back all those years later, and then even Top Boy, you know, the ones that you sort of weren't involved in, they all explore those issues of you know, teenagers and people growing up on those estates in London. What do you think it is that makes that particular sort of genre or subgenre, whatever you want to call it, just so popular?
I think what makes those things popular is, firstly, you know, at relatability in terms of that, if you're a working class person, you know, working class, you earn a crust, you work hard, you live in council estate or near them, everybody knows people like that. Whether you're involved or not, whether it's in Liverpool or London or Manchester, everybody knows somebody's cousin's got nicked, or their friend who does that, or the guy that robs the shops all the time, or everybody knows. So it's relatable. It's relatable. It doesn't mean you're involved in it, but it's relatable to working class people. And I think also for me, as being a person of color, I think those sorts of genres, especially back then, was kind of the only voice we were allowed to have. Like when I wrote stuff about being a doctor or whatever like that, people were kind of like, I don't believe this. But when I wrote stuff like that, they were like, oh, this is wonderful. This is wonderful. I'm like, I can hear your voice in there. I'm like, well, it was still my voice when I wrote about being a doctor, mate. But it was harder for people back then to understand it, which is why if you look at Bulletproof only now, 2020, or when do we, 2018, two black police officers. Why is that the first show that's done it in 2018? Like, it's crazy. But it's because years before, people couldn't really get their head around it. Yeah. But I think, you know, in terms of not being about race, just being working class and being not rich and just grafting your butt off and earning a crust, I think people know people like that, which is why those shows and things are relatable to a bigger audience.
And being from West London, people, I suppose, would maybe be one of the first questions to ask you when you say which football team you support, the reason you're obviously joining us today, people would ask maybe why you became a Liverpool fan. Was there a sort of conscious point in your life where you thought, well, now I'm going to be a Liverpool fan, like a certain player or moment, or has it just been a thing from sort of as long as you can remember?
It's been a thing for ages. I mean, people even, you know, when I was having the laughs and rows of those idiots on Twitter the other week was just cracking me up, man. They think I get upset. I'm cracking up laughing at some of these idiots, how offended they get. It just makes me laugh. But it wasn't I didn't go, oh, they've won trophies. I mean, I was like 5 years old, man. Some people were like, well, of course you just supported them when you were in the 80s. They were winning. I was like 5 years old. So what happened was basically my mom came from Trinidad and was studying, was doing her nursing. And she trained up here and a bit in Hastings and all that kind of stuff. And when I was about five, didn't really know about football, to be honest, because my dad wasn't about massively to take me out and, you know, do that stuff. A lot of my friends started supporting football teams. And I go to school, five, six, whatever, and they'd be talking about football. And I'd just be there not really knowing what they're talking about. So I went home, I said, Mum, everyone's talking about football. Can I get a ball? Yeah, you can get a ball. What team should I support? She's from Trinidad, mate. She ain't from England, right? There's no dad going, oh, you got to support your local team, son. There's none of that. So she said, all right. And I think a couple of days later, there was a game on. And she said, oh, support the red team. Your favorite color is red, support the red team. And it happened to be Liverpool. It could have been anyone, but it happened to be Liverpool on that day. I mean, like I said, you're talking, I'm five. This is like you're talking 1981, right? Someone said, well, we won this, that, they won that, that. I didn't know anything about trophies. I didn't know what the league was. It was like, I could go to school the next day and they go, who's your team? And I went, Liverpool. That's all it was for me as a five-year-old kid. It wasn't about, you know, knowing who won what European championship. I mean, I had no clue. And that's when it started. And my personality is that as such, I'm very loyal. So I just stuck with it through all my growing up years. And the amount of stick I got was unreal, but I stuck with it because, that as simple as that. I made a choice, and so I just stuck with it.
And what makes me laugh, because I wasn't born in Liverpool either, so I can sort of relate to that sort of, you know, that banter that people give you. And people would always call me a glory hunter, and I was born in 1995, and I always go like, what glory do you think? What glory do you think I've
seen?
Seventh
place glory, sixth place glory, yeah, whatever position it was
then. Yeah, Roy Hodgson, yes.
Oh my God, yeah. But yeah, back up, yay, semi-final.
But obviously, this year is a year for glory, of course. We stopped the league title drought of 30 years. But 100%. I suppose it didn't quite go how we all imagined it with the pandemic and stuff like that. So how did you manage to sort of, you know, celebrate the moment that it was confirmed we won it and celebrate, you know, it was lifting the trophy and things like that?
I mean, it was agonising. You know, when they talked about cancelling the season, you know, I was about to find the FA headquarters, like turn up at their door. And like keep the door in. Do you know what I mean? I was like, nah. They can't be cancelling the season. I was really panicking, thinking, would any other team have this? And I was like, no other team would have this. So surely all the teams are going to say no. And luckily they said, no, we're not cancelling, right? But the wait was agonizing. And I think it's still, you know, it was beautiful. I was at home. I watched the Chelsea match when we clinched it. My kids are Chelsea, and I'll explain that in a minute. And I watched, obviously, when we lifted the trophy, and it's just a beautiful thing. I feel the only thing I feel like is, had the season continued, we would have got more points, broke the records, and all that. I think the delay, and then the relief of winning. Not that you want to admit your team done this, but the relief of winning. I think everyone was like, ah, we've won it. And the last couple of games, not the last game, but, you know, you kind of see that the foot was off the pedal a little bit. When I was like, I want 104 points. Come on, boys. Do you know what I mean? I think the foot was off the pedal a bit, but or whatever it was possible to get. But it was beautiful, man. Just to see Henderson. I got to say, man, I love the kid, but I never thought I'd see him like lifting the trophy, mate. Beautiful. The amount of trophies that kid's lifted in the last year. He could retire tomorrow if he wanted. You know what I mean? He's great for the team, and it was good. And even I felt bad for the new players. You know, they came in what, January, played like two games, and then it was a 4-month gap. And then some of them got enough games in to get a medal. But I was like, did they even know anyone? Like, I just felt, you know, but it was beautiful to see it, man. I enjoyed it all. Loved it. I can't wait till we get to do something, whether it be mid-season or whatever, when all the fans are in the stadium and they can just lift the trophy in front of all the fans and have a little fireworks thing again. They should definitely do that, you know, even if it's mid-season, just so the fans get to, you know, see it with the team.
So I've clung on to that. You say your kids are Chelsea. That must have been a good night in your house, but explain that to us then.
So going back to when I was young and just how I stick to things, all the stick I got growing up being a Liverpool fan, and like, oh, didn't your dad or mum teach you to support your local team? I always said to myself, you know, whenever my kids are born, wherever they're born, they're going to support their local team. And I was just like, I'm going to stick to that. I'm not going to have them go through. I'm Liverpool. That is it. That's the be all and end of it. But, and this is years ago, before I even had kids, I said, because of everything that happened to me, I'm going to make sure whenever my kids are born, they support their local team, and I'm going to stick to it. That's what I'm going to do. So they're not going to get stick. They're going to support the team right where they were born, the nearest stadium. And they're born in Chelsea and Westminster Hospital, which, if you know the area, is you could probably take a free kick and hit Stamford Bridge. So that's the reason. I know it might not. I know it's odd for some people to compute, but it was a matter of principle for me. And so, you know, they grew up and they're all Chelsea fans.
They ever look at you now that Liverpool are winning all these trophies and go, Dad, like, what were you thinking about?
What have you done? Yeah. I'm like, he's teaching you a lesson, boys. He's going to go through what I went through. Nah, they'll be all right. I'm pretty sure they'll get one in the next 2 years. You know, hopefully we surround it and we keep getting them, but I'm pretty sure they'll be back. They'll be all right.
Yeah, we mentioned the sort of glory hunter thing before, and there is something in that, because look, as Liverpool fans, we've been spoilt to a degree down the years. Look, we've seen Champions League wins and things like that. We've seen really good teams have goes at the Premier League title. But what would you sort of say makes this particular team so special?
I think you say the word in there, team. I think you say the word in there. Like, the team is special because it is an absolute team. I'll be honest with you. There isn't any of those signings when they came in that I was like, oh my God, yes. Do you know what I mean? None of them. I'll be honest. There wasn't any of them. You know, like some teams, they'll sign a Messi or someone's just signed or a Sancho, you know, and you're like, oh, mate, that player, why can't, you know, that player is going to make all the difference. And, you know, during our drought and all these things, yeah, we're winning the sporadic trophy, but, you know, you got people like Mane, who's just a class, one of the best in the world. But when he came in from Southampton, was it?
Yeah.
When he came in, I wasn't like jumping off my chair because I didn't get it. I didn't understand what the manager, what people were building. And I think this is my point, is like, they're a team. That team there is, I mean, not unstoppable, but, you know, unstoppable. Do you know what I mean? Because they all work together and the way they gel together is immense. Whereas some teams, you have a bunch of people, you're like, I don't know who that is. And they've got one star player or two star players. I think this whole team has become stars because of the way they mesh together. And that's what I like about them. I don't mean that disrespectfully. Like, I love the team. I love the players. You know, it's just that, you know, when they were signed, I wasn't like jumping off my seat going, mate, we've got a Neymar, we've got an Mbappe or whatever like that. It was just kind of like, okay, this is interesting. You know, okay, he's from Southampton. All right. He's from here. He's from that. You know, people are spending 90 million and we're buying people for 8, 11, 20. You know, you're kind of like, come on, man. But that Jurgen Klopp, man, and actually, to be fair, Fenway Sports, I've heard about the formula and stuff they use. You can't knock it, mate. Can't knock it, because their Boston Red Sox won their world thing as well, and they'd never won it before. You know, so they can keep doing it for all I care. Buy someone who's 2 million, as long as they win in the Premier League, I don't care, mate.
Yeah, and we do another podcast called Desert Island Goals, which we'll have to get you on in the future, because I'd be really interested to hear some of your sort of stories around this. But basically, on that, we get people to talk about their favourite ever Liverpool goals and moments and things like that. So without sort of treading too much into that territory, just in case we do get you on, what's been your favourite moment from the sort of last few seasons of following this team? Is there a particular sort of game or goal or just a moment that stands out?
The last few seasons. What, the last 5 years or whatever?
Like, well, since Klopp took over, really, just this team.
Oh, mate, Barcelona Champions League semi-final.
It's got to be
second leg. I mean, what in God's name was that? In my life, I mean, there was an Olympiacos match. I know Klopp wasn't there yet. That was
Rafa, yeah.
Yeah, Gerrard scored that. That was a while back. No, yeah, the Barcelona... I thought the Champions League final in 2005, when we came back, couldn't be topped. But I honestly feel like this, to beat them 4-0, if they had scored and we won 4-1, I'd be like, guys, mate, we couldn't have done any more. But to shut them out from 3-0 down and win 4-0 is just unreal. Unreal. I think people should watch them games back to back. You know, like a little movie night, whatever, putting them back on. And it's just like, it's like Rocky, isn't it? It's the most amazing comeback ever. So for me, that for sure.
And we'll obviously be going into this new season as defending champions, which sort of sounds very nice, has a bit of a ring to it. And we're obviously all hoping we do go a bit further in the Champions League again this season. But what are you sort
of
expecting?
I don't care. I don't care, mate.
Yeah.
I really do not care. Like, honestly, I want to win every trophy for sure, right?
Yeah.
But legitimately, Premier League was evaded us for so long that getting it, I just want to win it again. So nobody can say it was a fluke. Nobody can say, like, we're not going to get it for another 30 years. I don't care if we drop out of every cup in the first round, apart from the money it brings in. I want the Premier League again. Do you know what I mean? But obviously, if we get to the final, Champions League, sure, great.
Well, we obviously got United to catch in the Premier Leagues now, but Bayern Munich have just caught up with the Champions Leagues as well. So you're hoping that maybe we can overtake them again.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. I think we will. I mean, hearing rumours about who City sign in, and Chelsea are bringing a few players in, that Kai Havertz and stuff like that. I reckon, well, it depends who we bring in, because this team was, you know, head and shoulders above everyone. But then occasionally, you know, like when we, the last Man City game, and you think, actually, they kind of took us apart a bit. You know, was that because we relaxed or because we knew we were going to win the title? And you're like, that can't happen. That can't happen, you know. So this team actually could easily win it again if they're on point. I feel like a few people need to come in, obviously, just to bolster the squad. But it will be tough. Like everything, when you win by that bigger gap, everybody else strengthens their squad. You know, and some of the people I'm hearing that are coming into some of those teams, they're just like, ooh, that might be tricky. But, you know, I don't know if they'll have the team that we have, the team, you know, that everyone going for each other, not, you know, getting the ball back when they lose it, just chasing down. I mean, it's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, and it remains to be seen what will sort of happen next for Liverpool, of course. I'm football in general, I guess, with the whole pandemic. But what's next for Noel Clark then? Is there anything you've got in the pipeline or any projects you're working on at the moment?
Yeah, well, you know, there's my company's got a film called Twist coming out that we produced. We also got a Channel 5 show called The Drowning. And then also Tiger Aspect in association with my company, Unstoppable, doing a show called Viewpoint in Manchester, which I'm acting in. I'm in Manchester right now, which I'm acting in. So all of those things to come out next year. Oh, and I've got a movie called SAS Red Notice, which is coming out with Andy Serkis and Tom Hopper and Sam Heughan. So there's a few things coming out, and, you know, just grafting. It's always grafting, mate, keeping the work going.
I was going to say, you sound like a busy man with all that going on. So we do really appreciate you giving us your time in between all that. Thank you very much for
coming. No problem, mate. Thanks for having me.
It is John Gibbons, and I'm joined over Zoom by Carl Kopak, not to talk about the Reds, but to talk about football, and specifically a football quiz that he's running through where, I guess you call it, Carl, the British Heart Foundation, doing a big footy quiz for us all to pretend we're all in a rammed boozer or fighting for each other to who's the smartest.
That's pretty much what we're aiming for, yeah. We're trying to put like a, well, it's an online quiz because obviously we can't really go to the pub and argue about, you know, who said what and who wrote what down at that point. And I told you it was that, you know, that sort of thing. So, you know, the usual thing we've all done before. So now with the British Heart Foundation, who I've been working for the last 6 years, are putting together a quiz. It's really, to be honest on it, it's mostly because it's the run-up to the season. You know, we want to get people's imaginations going and just before up to the, you know, before we all kick off at the weekend. After that really long break we've all had. So, and it's a quiz hosted by Chris Stark at the from Radio 1, who does the Peter Crouch podcast.
Yeah, I think he's Lizzie's mate, technically. I think he's
really
some stuff with Lizzie Doyle.
Oh, my God, she's not going to get the questions, is she? Can't do without that. We've got David Seaman, who's been one of our ambassadors for years now, and we've got Glenn Hoddle, who, of course, had a cardiac arrest while working at BT Sports. It's probably been about nearly 2 years ago now, I suppose. So, you know, it's something that they really believe in. And ideally, we want everyone to have a good time and to get everything right. I'll be honest here, I've written some of the questions. You're not going to be too perplexed by what's going on. Let's just say that. I've written it with a certain audience in mind. And we just want it to be a laugh and more than anything else, and get everyone's minds fully back onto the new season. And more importantly, as far as I'm concerned, is getting some much-needed cash into back into the coffers again, because we really need it.
Yeah, it's worth sort of highlighting that, really, Carl, isn't it? Because although it's been a tough year for lots of people in lots of different ways, for charities in particular, I would argue, you know, lots of people do things for fundraising that they haven't been able to do. You know, clearly stuff like the London Marathon and makes a big difference, you know, in terms of stuff like that. But it's, you know, it's the little small things that every weekend that people are doing and people are going on that aren't able to take place anymore.
It's huge. Yeah. I've got one volunteer, for example, who trained all the years to do the Great North Run, because his wife's first husband died of a heart attack. He's not too well either. He does all the training and it gets cancelled. So he's running around Tooton Common. God knows how many times, and it's little things like that which we miss, to be honest. You know, obviously things like the London Marathon, that's a huge wad of cash just gone, just absolutely gone. And it's the British Heart Foundation, we're the biggest funder of cardiovascular research in the UK. Like, no one even comes close to what we do, and to have all that money gone, it means, like, you know, we're missing out on advancing you know, health, really. So we really do need as much help as possible. And I understand it when people say, yeah, but, you know, jobs are going and things like that. You know, charity is the last thing on our mind. But literally, we're talking about health here. So, you know, we've had to cut a lot of research, which is, you know, not great for us at all. So we just need to sort of get back on track again and hopefully solve a few issues, shall we say.
So it's Thursday, the 10th of September. It's at 7 o'clock. It's testing in knowledge. They've said what the rounds are, which is helpful, so you can revise. It's the Premier League, the FA Cup, Euro 96, and the World Cup. I hope Dave Seaman's doing the Euro 96 round. But to be fair, he won a few FA Cups as well, and Premier League. So he could have a decent stab at a few of those. So if people want to get involved, what do they do?
Go to the website, the British Heart Foundation website, put in online footy quiz. We've gone with footy rather than football, and register your interest there. It's a text to donate, so you don't have to pay anything in advance or anything like that. Once you've registered on the website, you'll basically get like a reminder saying, don't forget it's tomorrow night. Get your Rothmans yearbook out. God, how old does that sound? I've said that.
See where you got your questions from?
Possibly. I can't possibly say. No, it's... That gets you a reminder and everything. And to be honest, it's a laugh more than anything else. It really is. And, you know, we do need your cash and everything, but we really want people to enjoy it as well. And because I set some of the questions, there aren't quite as many Liverpool questions as I wanted to go in there. And I had to be careful about editing some questions about other guests, shall we say. Like, you know, who did John Barnes score that goal against QPR? Who was the keeper that day? Now, I've not done all of that. Then I've cut that out.
Oh, fantastic. Do try and get involved. Do obviously support the charity and support Carl as well. But thanks a lot, Carl, for joining us. As Carl said, it's the British Heart Foundation website. If you go to Footy Quiz from the register, you receive a link on the night and you can get involved. Best of luck with it, Carl.
Thanks very much. Cheers. Thanks, everyone.
Welcome back. It is the weekender. We are finishing off talking about Liverpool women's first game of the new season in the Championship after they got relegated last season. I'm going to talk about it here, and everyone's got differing levels of knowledge and awareness around Liverpool women and the issues surrounding not just Liverpool women but women's football in general in this country. Those issues can go back many a year. Women were banned from playing football professionally in this country in the 1920s, just at the point at which they were getting huge, bigger and bigger crowds, and that ban sustained until 1973. You may wonder why I'm talking about that. It should be ancient history, but it actually has a massive influence on the way in which the game is discussed today. We're going to go through everything, really. And as I say, we booked this show some time ago, and we didn't book it with necessarily an expectation we would talk about this, but that's sort of what we want. We want people to be representative of our views, and it's all right not to know things in this area, and we can all learn together across this season. And as part of that, in that backdrop, we've got to apologise to you. The Anfield Rap hasn't done enough in its existence around Liverpool women's football in general. And so part of the reason why you, the listener, may not feel sufficiently informed, well, you know, the Anfield Rap at times gets to act like it's not part of the media, but we sort of are. So we've got a cop for this as well, as much as we point the finger anywhere else. So we'll have a general chat about that, about how Liverpool women have been run this decade, women's football. And then we will also obviously be talking about the game on Sunday, because this is meant to be enjoyable. And I, for one, I'm getting to go to the match on Sunday, which will be the first time I've seen organised football since Atletico Madrid at home, and I am practically giddy, and I am just wondering whether or not I can smuggle a hip flask in. More on that to come. In general, Chloe, you happened to mention before, just when we were chatting off air, that you did have an appreciation of what was going on with Liverpool women, and then that sort of ebbed away. A number of reasons. One was that you got a season ticket for the men's team. The timing of these games is a little bit difficult, but in a sense, and I don't mean this to be patronising, you are sort of a bit of the target market for Liverpool women in one sense. And across the course of the decade, it is fair to say that your interest has ebbed.
Yeah, I think growing up, you know, I used to play football, and at one stage I did want to be a footballer. And that's just a dream, as you are as kids. When you have a passion for something, that's what you want to do. You don't have to think about bigger scenarios. But, you know, the older I got, the more I realised that women's football is at so much of a disadvantage, that you could go and play football and put so much time into training. And you know, how much time do you put in outside of football into training and to get, you know, that physicality to then go and play these games. But at the same time, nothing's guaranteed. You know, you still might have a second job to support yourself financially. And not just that, but when you do something and it's not as invested in, not just financially, but also in advertisement, and also the idea of getting people to watch and wanting people to watch, it kind of seems less of a point. And I'm not meaning that in any disregard to the women's football, but when I grew up and I got older, I realised that playing football as a female, you were so much at a disadvantage compared to the men's game that for me it just felt pointless to even try. So, you know, and luckily, you know, at this point I can still do something within football, and that's all I've ever dreamed of doing. So that's fine. But when I look at the women's game, and I used to watch it, I used to go to the games, I used to, even though I watched the men's game, I never used to compare them. Because, you know, one thing has so much more investment in and development, and the other certainly doesn't. And I think last season, I want to say, Liverpool earned, you know, commercially over 400 million, I think, which is more than, you know, any other team. It was like an outstanding figure. And I think last year, Liverpool women's overall for everything earned £800,000. And, you know, when people compare men's and women's football, I think it's very unfair, because try and compare £400 million to £800,000. I think, you know, we can instantly target the one area of investment, and that's rightfully so. I look at Lyon, and their women's team dominates women's football. I think it's won 6 Champions League. I think it's won 4 in a row, I think. You know, their team is head and shoulders above every other team that plays, no matter whether it's from the WSL or it's from anywhere else in Europe. They are the best team, and that is partly due to how much investment's put in. You know, they have money to go and spend because they're allowed to go and spend this money. And I think it's also, as a consumer, as a viewer, it's your fault as well, because, you know, for me, I watch women's football when I see it. You know, if there's a game on, I'll watch it. But if there's men's football, I'll be watching men's football first. I wouldn't care what league it's in. And that is partly my fault. It's partly because of the advertisement, because I don't, unless I, you know, click through the channels and see there's a women's game on TV, I don't actually know that there's a women's game on TV. And I think sometimes, you know, we can blame the investment. We can blame the fact that we look at football and we look at women's football and try and compare it to men's football instead of just, you know, having it for what it is. And I think without, you can say what you want. Did you want to jump in?
I was just going to jump in. I was going to actually just jump in and use that as an opportunity to go over to Cathy, because it was interesting when Chloe sort of almost referred to a role model question. There's also a little thing in there, I think, as well, when she mentions the Lyon side. I mean, and this is where there is this strange sort of link, Cathy, and why to talk about the non-existent nature of the game for 50 years from the 20s to the 70s is sort of significant. But that all-conquering Lyon side last week had Alex Greenwood in, Lucy Bronze, Shanice van der Sanden, all of whom have been on Liverpool's books in the recent enough past. And Jodie Taylor from Birkenhead came off the bench as well. And yet, you know, Liverpool have had these players. They've had these players at the club. They've had them across the last sort of 10 years at some stage or another. They've had them involved, and they haven't been able to retain them. And, you know, what Chloe's talking there about sort of profile, about knowing and how it's covered and how it's discussed. All of that is mixed up here, and we can talk about what Liverpool women got wrong last season, or what Liverpool Football Club have been getting wrong with Liverpool women for a few seasons. But the problems around a lot of this stuff the roots do go a lot deeper.
Yeah, I think so. And I think there's been a missed opportunity in recent years, and we've been overtaken by other clubs, as is evidenced by, you know, these excellent players that have gone on to play anywhere else. And I think there are a few issues here. I think one is that there's a real lack of leadership. I think there's another issue, which is, for me, is about, you know, damaging the brand of Liverpool Football Club. And I think the third thing that you said about it being also up to us as fans and as people talking about the game, you know, to think about this in a different way. I first went to see Liverpool women when they played on Fairfield Police Ground over 20 years ago. And I have to say, do not think that I'm claiming to be some great fan who's been to loads of Liverpool women matches over the years, because I haven't. Because this was terrible. I mean, this was, they were playing on a field. I mean, it was just awful. And I said to Rick Perry at the time, I can't believe we've got this team that is playing in our shirts. Like, I was saying to him, this isn't for me an issue about women. I'm not coming to you as a woman saying them. I'm saying this is a Liverpool fan. Like, this is embarrassing. Like, either do this properly or don't do it at all, you know?
Yeah.
And he said, well, you know, they're not really our team. You know, we let them have the shirts. And I was like, don't let them have the shirts, because this is just, this looks really bad for us. Like, do it properly. And I don't think really that Liverpool have ever properly grasped this. I think over the years, there's been a lack of leadership where it hasn't really been integrated into the strategy. I totally get that the focus has been on, you know, the men's team, let's win a league, let's put it all into this, but it doesn't have to be at the expense of how you grow the club in other areas. And I think the club still has an opportunity now to rebuild. But I do think there really needs to be that leadership. You know, it's interesting that they've announced that Susan Black is going to be taking more of a role in this area. But if she's also still director of comms, then how much time is she going to be able to dedicate? I don't quite know yet how that's going to work.
I think it would help, Cathy, just, I mean, you've lived this reality. Do you think it would help to an extent that Susan Black could just be a voice in the room? That even if she's losing some arguments, she's at least present to have them. And maybe that's one of the things that the Liverpool women's setup has lacked, is people having its interest in the room.
Yes, I mean, it absolutely needs somebody to have that and to drive that forward and really to integrate it. And by that, I mean, you know, so many of us talk. I mean, I'm lucky I'm a season ticket holder, but so many people talk about, I just want to be able to go and see the Reds. You know, like you said, I just want to see a game. I want my kids to see a game. And then people are going to see the reserves or, you know, in my case, going to see City or Liverpool or whatever, or they go and see AFC or they go to other games. I'm like, go and see the women. But we don't do that. And as Chloe says, it's not always in our minds to do it. I'm a total glory hunter. I mean, I went home with Kelly Simo when we won the league. You know, she was like, we're in witness, we're going to win the league. And I was like, yes, I'm there, you know, give me a trophy. But I think for me, the integration would be, you know, everybody, there's so many people on the waiting list, you know, that are trying to get tickets for games. I would integrate it into the loyalty scheme. You know, I'd be giving people points for going to the games, and maybe not everybody would welcome that. But you know what? Maybe that would mean that people would say, actually, this is part of being a Liverpool supporter, is going to these games as well. And then maybe they would think, actually, you know, this is okay. And this is part of supporting Liverpool, is to support the women as well. Because other teams have overtaken us. You know, Man United waited and didn't do this until they wanted to do it properly. Now they've overtaken us. And you've got other clubs that are employing directors of women's football and really seeing this as a strategy and looking at, you know, where they can play. Like, we played at Tranmere on a rubbish pitch because we didn't even want to invest in it properly.
Mm.
And then you end up paying the price for that. And we, you know, okay, we got relegated on points per game, but we put ourselves in that position. And I don't feel confident at the moment that I can see us being in a situation where we would get back up into the Super League next year.
There's, within it all, the question is, Dan, is what gets the attention? What gets us going to the matches? What gets us paying attention? And I think there has been a little bit of an inconsistency and an issue in general for the league as a whole, both the WSL and now the Championship, where Liverpool women are in terms of the timing of the game. There's huge issues around the inconsistency of the schedule. We found, talking about on the Anfield Wrap across the last couple of seasons, you put a bit of a push into Liverpool women playing at home. And if people just couldn't make it, which sometimes happens, people would say, so when's the next play at home? And you'd say, it's about 6 weeks, mate. Because of the way in which all this sort of stuff goes, you know, at times you do feel as though it is an unnecessary slog, but I think it is something that people can choose to engage with, and the way in which it stops becoming an unnecessary slog, and the way in which people start getting behind it properly is through enjoyment, is through people committing to paying attention to it and having a good time while they do so.
Yeah, I think it's a strategy problem, this, that the club have got. I think the happy brand in it, in terms of merchandise and Nike and stuff like that. But, you know, as something I read this morning rightly pointed out, you know, you go on the club's Twitter account and they can't tell you what the last result was or, you know, who scored the last goal. It feels very promotional in that sense. And I think that the club are perhaps stuck in terms of treating it like they would treat the first team, men's team, the under-23s, men's team, the under-18s. I think what they need to do is sort of almost treat it as a blank canvas in many ways and say, look, we can build a community here.
Yeah.
We can build a community of people from the ground up. And if doing this is important for that community of people, then that's enough. You know, and then dedicate the resources in that sense. I mean, the club has a massive of resources and women's football, you know, let's not patronise. Women's football won't stand still. They'll be using data. They'll be using sports science, all the things that the men's game uses. So, you know, you can't do this half-arsed, is my point, because, you know, if you think about this club's sort of mantra, in the past few years, it's one of harmony and it's one of togetherness. Now, I'm not having that aside that I think if I read right, scored two goals last season, is a good workplace to be, a good environment. I'm not having that, a healthy environment to be around, because I've been in bad dressing rooms myself, and when results are constantly going against you, morale is on the floor. So if this was the club shop, I'd say the same thing, that if something is wrong there, get it right, because it doesn't fit the value of this club right now. And they're very much a massive part of this club. So yeah, for me, just taking a sort of external view. And the reason, you know, I take an external view is personally because football is very draining for me, because I work in it full time. And the same reason I don't watch the women's, the same reason I don't watch Serie A or Ligue 1 or whatever you want, in terms of other football, I find it very sort of energy consuming to just about keep up with Liverpool in the Premier League, to be quite honest. And I'm not the target audience, but there is that community of people there who, by getting those together, can then get others together by virtue of that. You know, young people can get to go to the game.
Yeah.
Women can take an interest in it. Fathers can take an interest in it. I think it just needs a complete new rebrand and strategy.
There's something to be said and about where we're complacent, Adam, and by we, I obviously mean the men. But something that we can be complacent about, which is, I've always said, role models within sport, that because you end up with so many, you almost feel as though role models aren't a thing, because there isn't an absence of them. You know, there's the Anfield Rap Commission's a mural of Trent Alexander-Arnold that sits near the ground, which references the fact that he is somebody who is representative of a generation of people from Liverpool. And it strikes me that for not just for the last sort of 5 years or so, but historically, and it's a national thing, it's not a Liverpool thing, we've removed the idea of putting, for women, people who look like them at the forefront of the national game, of the sport itself. That the idea, and you, because we dominate those conversations, mostly white men dominate those conversations, that's not up for debate, it's the reality of it. It gets forgotten all too quickly, because you're unable to, what you just sort of take for granted, what you see around every corner, somebody else who's just like you on every pitch, is something that you can't even imagine the opposite. It becomes very, very difficult to do so. And I think that that's one of the, you know, this is a historical conversation. It is not one that just exists in the last 5 years, even where Liverpool women are concerned, in general for the whole game. I think it is one where we do have to show sort of collectively a level of humility and say we're part of 100 years of things not being right, not part of 5 years of things not being right.
I mean, 100%. And I think that, look, if we were sat in a room now and we were having a conversation about what can we do for the women's game, then probably the two big things that I would put onto the table and say this is something we need to talk about is, one, targeting kids. I completely agree with Dan about what he was saying, but I think there is a reality that we have to face, and we have to acknowledge that there are vast swaths of men that will, when the conversation of women's football comes up, they'll say, are any of them fit? That will be what some people will say, with vast swaths of men will ask the question. Now, those people shouldn't be given the time of day, but we've got to acknowledge they exist, right? And we have to ask, well, how do we get past that? And one of the ways I think we get past that sort of innate sexism and things like that around the women's game is by targeting younger people to go and to get into the football as young people, and then they will carry on watching it. And exactly as you say, they will then have idols, they will then have people that they will look up to, they will then have all of that thing that they just lack right now in any way, shape or form. I mean, if you put a gun to my head and said name a member of the Liverpool women's football team, I would just go Sarah Roberts. I wouldn't have a chance. I would lose my brain, because I wouldn't have a chance of being able to figure out who it is, because it's just not part of it. And that comes me onto the second point that I put on the table, and that is that the Liverpool women's team particularly, and I think women's football in general, could do with having different owners to the men's team, because the women's team will always come secondary to the men's team. And right now we're looking at a world where there's a global pandemic on, where people are saying sign Thiago, where people are going, I can't believe we don't have the money for X or Y or Z or whatever it might be. And FSG aren't going to be looking at it and going, we should defo invest loads of money in the women's team. Because they're going to be going, whatever money we've got, if we don't invest it in the men's team, we're going to be getting lynched. You know, that's the kind of scenario that they're in right now, that the men's team will always take the focus as long as it's part of the same, all under the same umbrella. And that's a major problem. And I don't know how you shift that in the short term. I just don't know how you get to the point where it's not the thing. Even the conversation we're having now, we are all saying women's football, men's football, but we don't call it that. We call it football. So we're having to put the men's on to say that we're talking about the different thing. But the reality is, it is football, and women's football is football. It's like the two different sports, and that's how people talk about it. And we have to acknowledge that is a major battle to kind of compete with that. And that's why I think that there's almost an extent to which you go, look, there are older people of my age in the 30s, whatever, there are those who will be, you know, interested in coming to the women's football. Philippa Smallwood's a big, you know, proponent of it. She's always talking about it, always saying that people should go and watch it, etc. But you also have to acknowledge that there's that probably three quarters aren't going to be bothered. They're just not going to care. So you have to target something else and get them interested and kind of play the long game. And I don't know whether the ownership that we've currently got at the club are bothered about that. And I don't know how many supporters are bothered about it either.
The ownership thing's interesting, Cathy, in that I think one of the things you were wondering about before is a little bit more of a sense of independence, possibly, that there's possibly a way to set this up so there's an independence around the ownership. There's also, within that, there's a very valid conversation about the Football Association itself, that whether or not that needs to be broken up, because we are the sort of the decades of mismanagement that we're talking about in the wider field. You know, it's all happened under the remit of the Football Association, an organisation with many question marks around it. It is, a lot of this stuff is so structural that it becomes, you can get lost in the weeds of it a little bit. You can end up thinking ever so much about the structures and less about actually getting women on pitches playing football.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying there. I think that there's so much, it's so complicated, the structure of football, and so much of course is about where the money lies, you know. So it's very easy, it's very easy to blame the FA, especially as someone who was working at the Premier League, it's working in football basically means you just all point the finger at each other the whole time, But actually what I loved about my job was that I would be working very closely with people at the FA and the other leagues and the LMA and the PFA and all of that, and really trying to sort of navigate all of that, and go, well, how do we just work together to make this stuff work properly, And there's this debate now about whether the women's game then comes under the Premier League, because, of course, again, that's where the money lies.
Yeah.
And I think, and I get this, the Premier League tend to say, if you want us to put our money into this, then we want control over it.
Yeah.
We don't just want to give a load of money away and not know what's happening with it. If we're going to resource this properly. And it comes back as well, I think, to that really interesting point about whether you have different ownership, because I think there's a really strong argument for that. But then, of course, the money is in Liverpool's ownership at the moment, in the Liverpool men's team,
yeah,
in the overall club. And then again, if you're going to have the brand, if you like, used, you're going to want to have control over it. So I think often what football does is sort of go round in circles with these debates and never seems to actually to get anywhere with it. But I think there's a really important point that we haven't made yet about the women's game and about this being different and about, whether this feels like a different sport or not. That the elephant in the room for me is atmosphere, because it is different, and what I love about going to Anfield is the atmosphere, it's the crowd, it's being part of all of that. And any women's game that I've been to is different, whatever club it is just different. You're not actually going to take the piss out of players in the same way that you do. I mean, if I get a non-league, it is about that atmosphere and actually about taking the piss out of a player's hairdo or whatever. I can't see myself doing that with the women's team. I mean, it just wouldn't seem right. I mean, there's that whole sort of stuff. I mean, you can talk about where the line is in terms of the stick that you give players, but I think it's really, really different. And I think it comes back to that point that was being made by Adam and Dan about whether there's a different audience for this.
I think
how that integrates and how that changes. And now you get to the point where you get an atmosphere that you really want to be part of when you're at the game, which I do think some other clubs are building, but it's still different.
I think just come back to you very quickly on Cathy, we'll wrap the show up then. And also I'm going to talk about what we're going to do on Sunday. But there is, I think, being able to, for instance, say that pass was shite, matters. And I think that in general, and this is, I think this is, and I think that matters to those players. And one of the things that you get when you get the women's teams together and they're all talking about each other, I thought Leon had fantastic togetherness in the final. And by the way, the final, Leon versus Wolfsburg, was just a really good game of football. This wasn't a, you know, there wasn't a wider thing there. It was played at an absolutely ferocious pace. But there has to be, because we want this to be elite sport, therefore then there has to be what the trappings of elite sport. Where it is, we cannot applaud everything. We have to be, and in the same way that we find it easier to criticise Liverpool Football Club because God knows we've got years of experience, but we've also got to find it easier to say, well, yeah, but the left back was crap today. She just wasn't good enough. Yeah. And that's a massive step forward, isn't it?
Yeah, totally. I think that's one of the things that just feels odd about it at the moment for me, is that it doesn't feel like going to the game in the same kind of way, you know. And I think that's where we've got to get to. Where this really does just feel like going to a football match, which, you know, may have its differences, but at its core, it's still us going to support our team and the way that we support our team.
Excellent stuff. Just a couple of things for you then, if you want to take notice of this. The Liverpool Women Supporters Club, which has been brilliantly run and built from scratch. It's at LFCWSC on the Twitter, at LFCWSC on the Twitter. Do follow them and go from there with that. They are worth paying attention to. And when people can get back in the ground, I know they want to try to get a bit of a sense of supporter togetherness going and all of that sort of stuff. So they are worth paying attention to. Also, Liverpool play Bristol. Sorry, play Durham. It's the one with Bristol. Liverpool play Durham on Sunday, 6th of September, 2 p.m. kickoff. The FA player, you can watch it there. That match is available on the FA player and it can be watched there. So do take the opportunity to do that. You can download the FA player. It's got lots and lots of stuff on there around the WSL, the Women's FA Cup, the Continental Cup as well, where Liverpool got what, in our spirit of talking about the women's football, frankly, we can call a twat of a group this week. It is fair to say that it'll be a tough one for the Reds to get out of, but they'll do the best they can. That is there for you as well. But we will be doing a post-match show after Liverpool versus Durham on Sunday. We're going down. And trust me, if the left back was crap, we'll say so. In the meantime, thank you very much to Cathy Long, to Chloe Bloxham, to Dan Morgan, and to Adam Smith for the weekend of this week. Noel Clark as well in there. Take it easy, whatever you're doing this weekend. But we'll be with you to talk about Liverpool women on Sunday. Sports Social Podcast Network.